Here we go with the reading of today's Wall Street Journal for this wet and windy Thursday morning in May. It's May 22nd, 2025, and sitting in the pitch black studio, we say hello to Ken.
Hello and welcome. In yesterday's markets, bond yield tops 5%, highest since 2023, jolting stocks. Trouble has been stirring in the bond market for weeks. On Wednesday, the anxiety spread to the stock market. A weak auction for 20-year bonds exacerbated worries about rising deficits in Washington and drove sharp declines for stocks and bonds, sending the Dow Jones Industrial Average down more than 800 points and the 30-year Treasury bond yield to the highest level since 2023. Many investors have grown increasingly concerned about the Treasury issuance that could follow President Trump's multi-trillion dollar fiscal package. On Friday, Moody's Ratings stripped U.S. debt of its AAA rating, citing the government's towering pile of debt and kicking off selling in treasuries. Higher government deficits mean potentially elevated government bond issuance to fund the gap between spending and revenue, making some investors uneasy about how much of Washington's debt Wall Street can absorb. The yield on 30-year treasuries rose to 5.089%, the highest level since October 2023. Yields on 10-year government bonds rose to 4.595%. The S&P 500 fell 1.6%, while the tech-heavy NASDAQ composite lost 1.4%. The Dow shed 1.9%. The declines were broad-based, with 10 out of the 11 S&P 500 groups notching declines. Yields have been edging higher recently because of fears of deficits and higher inflation rather than a strong economy. Rates are rising for the wrong reasons, said Larry Adam, chief investment officer at Raymond James. Investors said there had been a lingering mismatch between signals from stock and bond markets, with stock investors largely brushing off concerns about higher deficits and inflation. With fears of an immediate trade war fading, stocks have clawed back their April losses and are about flat for the year. Bond yields have been climbing recently, not just in the U.S., but also in Japan and Europe, two other key markets where investors are anticipating wider deficits. That has added to the pressure on U.S. bonds. The rise in yields then gained momentum in the afternoon when the $16 billion auction of 20-year Treasury bonds attracted relatively soft demand from investors, selling at a higher yield than traders had anticipated. Demand for 20-year bonds has always been a bit soft relative to other Treasuries since they were introduced towards the end of Trump's first term. That is reflected in their yields, which have consistently exceeded those of 30-year bonds. Any auction, though, is still seen on Wall Street as an important gauge of demand. The disappointing results Wednesday reinforced concerns about appetite for longer-term treasuries in particular. The weak auction triggered selling in stocks and afternoon trading. The government's mammoth fiscal plan comes as many investors already are uneasy about the potential for rising inflation because of Trump's tariffs. Many people in the U.S. are feeling more gloomy about the economy than they have in years, and a handful of retailers, including Walmart, have announced plans to raise prices because of the tariffs. Some investors have said they are concerned about the prospect of stagflation, an unenviable combination of lower growth and higher inflation that investors haven't contended with in decades. As a result, the spring has been punctuated by moments of turmoil in bonds while investors grapple with higher tariffs and the prospect of a slowdown. In early April, investors broadly dumped U.S. assets, driving government bond yields higher so abruptly that even Trump took notice, announcing a pause on tariffs. This time, though, the rise in bond yields seems unlikely to deter lawmakers eager to push ahead with the plan for tax cuts and spending. Former Apple design guru set to take broad role at OpenAI. Partnership with IVE could herald a new era of AI-powered consumer technology. Joni Ive, a chief architect of the iPhone and his design firm, are taking over creative and design control at OpenAI, where they will develop consumer devices and other projects that will shape the future look and feel of AI. OpenAI chief executive Sam Altman and Ive's design firm, LoveFrom, have been working on a new device that will move consumers beyond screens, according to people familiar with the matter. They have been collaborating for 2 years on a closely guarded project, considering options including headphones and other devices with cameras, the people said. The partnership between Ive, a visionary designer, and OpenAI, which has transformed how consumers seek information, could herald a new era of AI-powered consumer technology. It puts a seasoned designer at the creative helm of a fast-growing startup that aims to one day have a hand in everything from devices to AI-powered robots, AI models with human-like intelligence, and a global network of data centers. The former Apple employee's work at OpenAI will extend across all the company's ventures, from future versions of ChatGPT to audio features, its app and other products, according to people familiar with the matter. London-born Ive left Apple in 2019 to found LoveFrom, a design firm that has worked for Ferrari, Airbnb, and the luxury Italian fashion firm Moncler. Ive also leads IO, a company founded last year to design and develop a new family of AI-powered products. As part of an unusual deal announced Wednesday, OpenAI will also acquire IO in an all-equity deal that values it at $6.5 billion. OpenAI acquired a 23% stake in the company late last year, people familiar with the matter said. OpenAI's startup fund also invested at the time. The acquisition of the rest of Ive's IO put an executive who helped change the relationship between consumers and technology at the forefront of development of devices that move consumers away from screens. IO's staff of about 55 engineers, scientists, researchers, physicists, and product development specialists will become part of OpenAI, while LoveFrom continues to operate independently. OpenAI will be a customer of LoveFrom, and LoveFrom will receive a stake in OpenAI, people familiar with the matter said. The companies expect the transaction to close this summer, pending regulatory approval. I have a growing sense that everything I have learned over the last 30 years has led me to this moment, I've said. Altman said he hopes the team can bring some of the delight, wonder, and creative spirit that I first felt using an Apple computer 30 years ago. Ivan Altman said in a joint statement that their work together grew out of friendship and collaboration. Altman has taken a number of steps to explore device and hardware options, investing in 2020 in the startup Humane, which launched what it called the AI Pin with OpenAI's technology that failed to catch on with consumers. Altman has long been fond of Apple and was eager to strike a deal with the iPhone maker when the company sought partnerships for the rollout of Apple Intelligence about a year ago. He has idolized Apple co-founder Steve Jobs, even though Altman has been outspoken in his criticism of smartphones and what he sees as toxic aspects of screen addiction. OpenAI's acquisition of IO points to its growing ambitions as a more consumer-centric company focused on mass-market products and impact. Altman recently hired Facebook and Instacart veteran Fiji Simo, an operations-focused executive who's tasked with helping the company become a profitable and publicly traded company. While much of Ive's work at Apple revolved around the specific look and feel of products in the physical world, he also took greater responsibility for software issues on certain devices towards the end of his tenure there. OpenAI has a content licensing deal with the Wall Street Journal's parent company, News Corp. Pentagon accepts Qatari jet president solicited. Donation of a plane as Air Force One has raised security and ethics questions. The Pentagon said Wednesday that it had formally accepted a donated $400 million luxury airliner from Qatar that President Trump has said will serve as Air Force One. The Air Force said it was preparing to award a contract to modify the jet so it can serve as the official presidential aircraft. It didn't provide further details about the plans, saying information related to the aircraft was classified. The Department of Defense will work to ensure proper security measures and functional mission requirements are considered for an aircraft used to transport the president, Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell said in a statement. White House officials said they hope the luxuriously outfitted Boeing 747-8 jet, offered to Trump by Qatar as a gift, will be ready to serve as Air Force One as soon as the end of the year. The decision to accept the donated commercial aircraft has raised security and ethics questions since Trump disclosed the offer last week. The administration has said the plane would go to the Trump Presidential Library at the end of his term. It isn't clear under which legal provisions the plane would be transferred to the library, former officials said. If the United States gets to keep the plane when he leaves office, then it's a gift to the United States. If he gets to keep it, then it's a gift to him and a violation of the Constitution, unless Congress votes to approve it, said Richard Bifalt, a Columbia Law School professor who specializes in government ethics. A provision of the Constitution, known as the Foreign Emoluments Clause, bars officers under the United States from accepting gifts of titles of any kind from a former government without congressional consent. Ronald Reagan's presidential library in California acquired an earlier version of Air Force One in 2003 after the plane was retired by the Air Force years after Reagan left office. The transfer was approved by the Air Force Secretary during the George W. Bush administration. At the White House on Wednesday, Trump was asked by a reporter about Qatar giving the U.S. a luxury jet. Sitting next to him, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa quipped, "I'm sorry, I don't have a plane to give you." "If your country offered the United States Air Force a plane," Trump said, "I would take it." The Justice Department cleared the proposed arrangement with Qatar in a memo signed by Attorney General Pam Bondi, a spokesman said. The timetable to have the plane ready by year-end could be nearly impossible to meet unless Trump, a Republican, is willing to forego many of the features that make Air Force One distinctive, according to industry experts in defense and former Air Force officials. Adapting a commercial airplane to transport the president and potentially serve as a command and control center requires modifications to the plane, multiple familiar with presidential aircraft capabilities said. The aircraft is equipped with numerous classified defensive and communication systems. Just repainting the donated aircraft could take 6 months, the people said. Trump is basically going to take that airplane as is with the modest modifications achievable in a few months, said Frank Kendall, Air Force Secretary during the Biden administration. He is getting something far less than Air Force One, and the country is only going to get it for 2 years' time. He can do it, but it's a bad idea for a lot of reasons. Some Republican lawmakers have raised national security concerns about using the Qatari plane as Air Force One, warning that scrubbing it for foreign surveillance technology would be costly and difficult. They have also questioned whether the plane would have the necessary capabilities or carry the advanced technology needed for an airborne White House. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the chamber's Democratic leader, said on the Senate floor that overhauling a foreign luxury plane to serve as Air Force One would cost billions of dollars and predicted it would ultimately add up to more than the value of the plane itself. National security experts from one end of the country to the other agree. No matter how many modifications are made or how much is spent or how intensely it is retrofitted, there will never be 100% confidence that the plane is secure, he said. Schumer said he would hold up the confirmation process for all political Justice Department nominees until he gets answers about the deal for the Qatari plane. The Wall Street Journal reported this month that the Trump administration commissioned defense contractor L3 Harris to retrofit the Qatari aircraft. Last week, an L3 spokesperson declined to comment. The current Air Force One was built in 1990. During Trump's first term, Boeing won the $3.9 billion fixed-price Air Force One contract and at one point was expected to have the replacement planes ready by last year, but it is years behind schedule. U.S. military officials said they expected Boeing to deliver the planes by 2027 at the earliest, but are planning for a more likely 2029 timeline. A Boeing spokesperson last week referred questions to the Air Force, which also declined comment. Two CEOs mixed romance, business, leading to scandal. Kohl's fired chief who didn't disclose his years-long relationship with supplier. The Vaquero Club is tucked away behind stone walls in a wealthy suburb of Dallas. The gates protect a swanky neighborhood of Texas-sized mansions, a pristine golf course, and a lake stocked with bass. Residents pay for seclusion and privacy, but it's one of those gated communities where secrets are hard to keep. On a recent Friday evening, Ashley Buchanan and Chandra Holt headed to the Vaquero Clubhouse for dinner, as they often do. Buchanan, 51, in a white polo shirt, and Holt, in a shaggy cream vest, sipped cocktails at the bar, according to a person who saw them. It was her 45th birthday. The pair showed no signs of having been engulfed in a corporate scandal that got Buchanan fired as CEO of Kohl's, which had become public just the day before. Earlier that week, Kohl's chairman and an outside lawyer had confronted Buchanan, according to people familiar with the matter. The Kohl's board was investigating after an employee raised red flags. Buchanan had helped broker a deal for Kohl's to sell products from a coffee startup called Incredibrew. It was run by Holt, and the CEO hadn't disclosed their personal relationship, violating the retailer's ethics code. Kohl's chairman, Michael Bender, had known Buchanan and Holt for years. The three executives had worked together at Walmart a decade ago. But Bender, who led the board that had hired Buchanan a few months earlier, didn't know they were a couple. The lawyer demanded to know, was Buchanan dating Holt? Yes, he replied. It was an admission of a relationship that had been gossiped about for years among employees, but kept out of view of many corporate leaders and board members. First at Walmart, then Kraft's retailer Michaels, and now Kohl's. But it wasn't really hidden. Both Buchanan and Holt had filed for divorce from their respective spouses in 2020. Court records showed an extramarital affair with Holt had a role in Buchanan's divorce, and the couple lived openly at Vaquero, where they played tennis together and share a $3 million stone house with a koi pond and private pool. While a CEO doesn't have to share his or her love life outside of work with the board, most companies require executives to disclose relationships that could result in potential conflicts of interest. Both Buchanan and Holt had run major retail chains. She had been CEO of Bed Bath & Beyond and another retailer. They had worked together and hired staff from each other's companies. Holt had also started a coffee brand that was being marketed to both Kohl's and Michaels when Buchanan was running them. Buchanan and Holt had largely kept quiet with co-workers in the companies that employed them about their romantic relationship, according to people who worked with them and court documents. Michaels tried to recruit Holt for a senior role soon after Buchanan became CEO of the Kraft's retailer in 2020, and Buchanan didn't disclose that he had a personal relationship with her at the time, according to one person familiar with the matter. Holt didn't end up taking the job. Later on, Buchanan also didn't disclose his relationship with Holt to some merchants. the employees who chose which products to buy when Michaels decided to sell Incredibrew at its stores. After he was fired by Kohl's, Buchanan's defense was that he made introductions for merchants but didn't require them to buy particular products, according to one person who spoke with him. On May 1st, Kohl's said it fired Buchanan for cause after an investigation by outside lawyers found he had violated the company's ethics code, saying he had helped arrange a deal to sell Holt's coffee products. Buchanan had dictated the payment terms, and the order was for hundreds of Kohl's stores, according to a person familiar with the situation. Kohl's said the terms were unusual and favorable to the vendor. The investigation also found that he caused Kohl's to enter into a multimillion-dollar consulting agreement at Boston Consulting Group, where Holt was an advisor at the time. In an interview that day, Holt said she has known Buchanan for 10 years. She said they weren't romantically involved when Michaels was looking to hire her and that her Incredibrew business hadn't been compensated by Kohl's. Boston Consulting Group said it was surprised to learn of Holt's relationship with Buchanan. As a result of this non-disclosure, we have terminated Chandra Holt's contract, BCG said in a statement at the time. The firm said it had employed Holt on a part-time basis to provide advice on retail topics. BCG said she wasn't involved in structuring the Kohl's assignment or negotiating any contract terms. The work for Kohl's hadn't started by the time Holt's contract was terminated, according to people familiar with the situation. Buchanan and Holt met a decade ago in Bentonville, Arkansas, when she took a job in 2015 as a vice president with Sam's Club, the warehouse chain owned by Walmart. Buchanan was running Walmart's dry grocery business at the time. Holt, a Minnesota native, had started her career at Target, where she spent a decade, then worked a few years at Walgreens. After she joined Walmart, Holt and her then-husband and young daughter moved into a home in the Pinnacle Country Club, a gated golf community near Walmart's headquarters that is filled with its top executives. Buchanan lived around the corner at Pinnacle with his then-wife and three daughters. The Texas native had worked at Walmart since 2007 and was a rising star within the executive team. He was known as a tough negotiator with Walmart's suppliers and as a blunt leader who gave his direct reports autonomy. At the start of 2017, Buchanan became Holt's boss after he was named chief merchant for Sam's Club. A few months later, Holt was promoted to lead the Sam's Club grocery business. The following year, she left his group when she was appointed chief operating officer of the chain's website. In northwest Arkansas, a region where many inhabitants have ties to Walmart or its suppliers, chatter circulated about Buchanan's close relationship with Holt. That was in part because Buchanan, Holt, and their children spent time together without their spouses, and in part because Buchanan discussed his troubled marriage with friends and co-workers, according to former and current Walmart executives. His wife had a serious illness, so he went on many social outings without her. He worried about his wife and the toll her illness took on their children, some of those executives said. Despite the troubles at home, Buchanan's career was advancing and he was viewed by some colleagues as a contender to take over as Sam's Club's next CEO. In November 2019, Sam's Club picked a new leader, but it wasn't Buchanan. He was named to another executive role at Walmart. Around Christmas 2019, Buchanan told Walmart U.S. Chief Executive John Furner that he was leaving Walmart to become the CEO of Dallas-based Michaels, according to some of the executives. Buchanan and his family made plans to move to Southlake, Texas, a western suburb of Dallas. On January 3, 2020, soon after they arrived, Buchanan filed for divorce, setting off legal proceedings that would later reveal the affair with Holt. Move to Texas. Holt was exploring a new role in early 2020. She had been approached by Michaels to serve in a top merchandising position reporting to the CEO, but a non-poach agreement with Walmart made the move difficult, and Holt stayed at Walmart, where she was promoted around that time. Her marriage was also troubled. She separated from her husband in March 2020, then filed for divorce in October of that year. The couple would twice call off their divorce before making it official in 2024, according to filings. In the summer of 2021, Holt left Walmart to become CEO of Conn's Home Plus, a regional home goods retailer based near Houston. As Buchanan and Holt moved their lives to Texas, they mostly kept their romantic relationship quiet. They recommended each other's companies to potential hires in some cases without disclosing their personal ties. For Conn's, Holt hired an executive that had worked at Michael's, where Buchanan was CEO. Top executives at Michael's said they didn't know the pair had a romantic relationship until more Walmart employees later joined the company, passing along gossip from Arkansas as Buchanan's divorce proceedings trickled into the open. In early 2021, shortly before Buchanan's divorce was finalized, private equity firm Apollo Global Management agreed to purchase Michael's and take it private in a $3.3 billion deal. Buchanan stood to receive $32 million from his stake in the deal, according to divorce filings submitted by his ex-wife's lawyer. His ex-wife sued to set aside their October 2020 settlement plan and accused Buchanan of fraud for not disclosing the coming transaction. Buchanan disputed the claim in court. Terms of the pair's final settlement aren't known. Incredibrew product. Holt left Conn's in October 2022 and founded Incredibrew, a company that sells K-cup coffee pods infused with supplements such as collagen and melatonin. It was incorporated in July 2023 at her then-home address near Houston, state records show. In early 2024, she was hired as CEO of Bed Bath & Beyond after the home goods chain had emerged from bankruptcy. By mid-June, she was out. The company said it was part of a leadership reorganization, and she didn't publicly comment at the time. She refocused on her coffee startup. Meanwhile, Buchanan was in discussions to join Kohl's as its CEO. The chain was looking for a new leader after years of sales struggles, pressure from activist investors, and strategy shifts. Days before Thanksgiving, Kohl's said Buchanan was taking over in January. The Incredibrew capsules started being sold at Michael's, nestled in the candy area near the cash registers. They were also being sold online. Some former Michael's employees told the Wall Street Journal they wondered at the time why the chain was selling coffee, since it doesn't have a grocery section. In a series of LinkedIn posts this year, Holt started promoting Incredibrew. She said she had been working on it for the past 2 years and unveiled new products. In one video, she talked about the health benefits of the collagen-infused coffee. "It's amazing for hair, skin, and nails, as well as bone and joint health," she said. Buchanan reposted the video, which appeared to have been filmed in front of a gas fireplace in the home they share in the Vaquero Club community. Holt said the pods would be available online at Walmart and Amazon. At Kohl's, Buchanan's brusque management style quickly ruffled feathers inside the Menomee Falls, Wisconsin headquarters. Buchanan had a residence in Wisconsin, but it isn't known how much time he spent there. With Buchanan's first months on the job, Kohl's was preparing to buy Incredibrew products. As part of the normal process of vetting a new vendor, a Kohl's employee raised concerns, according to people familiar with the probe. The board was notified, and an outside law firm conducted an investigation. On April 30th, Bender, the Kohl's chairman, and a lawyer called Buchanan to share the findings of the investigation, including the Incredibrew order and the arrangement with BCG, surprising Buchanan. That's when they confronted the CEO about his relationship with Holt. The following morning, Kohl's issued a statement that said Buchanan had been fired for cause. Bender stepped down as chairman to assume the role of interim CEO, while the retailer looks for a permanent replacement. Split House GOP races to pass spending bill. House Republicans were finalizing a series of last-minute changes Wednesday to their sprawling tax and spending bill, searching for a path that could unite the party's warring wings headed into a nail-biter floor vote. The new language, to assuage conservatives, would accelerate new Medicaid work requirements to December 2026 from 2029 and end certain tax credits for wind and solar energy instead of a slower phase-out through 2031. The updates would also formally lock in a $40,000 cap on the state and local tax deduction starting this year, up from a $30,000 cap in the prior plan. That change was designed to satisfy Republicans from high-tax states such as New York and New Jersey. Lawmakers from states such as Florida and Texas that haven't expanded Medicaid under Obamacare would get a favorable change to a funding formula, and broader states and border states would get a $12 billion for security costs incurred during the Biden administration. An indoor tanning exercise tax that was eliminated in the original bill text would be maintained, and a nuclear energy tax break would be expanded. Federal land swaps in Nevada and Utah would be eliminated. House Speaker Mike Johnson, R. Louisiana, spent Wednesday negotiating what leaders hope are the final details that unlock the magic combination ahead of a final vote that was expected early Thursday morning. He shuttled to the White House with hardliners from the House Freedom Caucus, who demanded faster, larger spending cuts and energy tax credit phase-outs, and then huddled with moderates who worry about ending the clean energy tax credits too quickly. Passage of the legislation would mark a major win for President Trump, a Republican, and a significant step towards extending to his 2017 tax cuts and cementing other conservative priorities. But in a House where Republicans have a narrow 220 to 212 majority and Democrats are deeply opposed to the plan, the measure could go down to the wire. Conservatives who were frustrated earlier Wednesday were less vocal later in the day, but didn't commit to voting yes. "I believe we are going to land this airplane," Johnson said during a hectic day of legislating that saw the House Rules Committee starting a hearing at 1 a.m. and continue past sunset. He is trying to finish the bill in the House before Memorial Day. It would then go to the Senate, and Republicans are aiming to get it to Trump's desk by July 4th. Broadly, the bill would combine a mishmash of Republican priorities into a single bill that carries the Trump agenda. It would extend expiring tax cuts and create new tax cuts on top of that, such as a larger standard deduction, a larger child tax credit, and versions of Trump's campaign trail promises to eliminate taxes on tips, overtime pay, and Social Security benefits. The bill would provide new money for broader security, national defense, and support for farmers. To cover some, but not all, of those costs, the bill would reduce spending on Medicaid and nutrition assistance. Those changes include new and tighter work requirements, more frequent eligibility checks, and shifts that would push more costs to states. None of this is easy because we're in a narrow majority, but it's critically important that we deliver policies to boost investment and wages, said House Majority Leader Steve Scalise. Before the final changes, the bill was expected to increase budget deficits by about $2.7 trillion over a decade, compared with a scenario where Congress does nothing. That figure was causing discomfort for some Republicans as the national debt and bond yields climb. Republican leaders say that faster economic growth from Trump's policies would fill the gap and make it deficit neutral, a point many economists dispute. Conservatives have warned that the bill front-loads tax cuts with 2028 expiration dates and delays spending cuts, creating pressure for future Congresses to extend Trump's proposals and further postpone pieces of the measure that reduce deficits. This Congress we control is actually grows the deficit, said Representative Warren Davidson, R. Ohio, who was on Wednesday evening, came out against the legislation. All this is the same play with a bunch more smoke and mirrors, he said. Democrats, meanwhile, highlighted the contrast between tax cut extensions for high-income households and spending cuts that would reduce health insurance coverage and remove benefits for low-income households. They pointed to a Congressional Budget Office analysis showing that the bill would reduce resources for the bottom 10% of households by income while giving more resources to those in the top 10%. You guys make Marie Antoinette look down to earth, said Representative Jim McGovern, D. Massachusetts. This is like crazy. I can't believe that you're doing this. Republicans said they were targeting waste and fraud in the safety net programs. Medicaid provides health care coverage to more than 70 million lower-income and disabled people. Under the new work requirements that would be imposed by the bill, most childless adults without disabilities between the ages of 19 and 64 would have to provide documentation that they worked 80 hours a month to qualify for Medicaid. The nonpartisan CBO estimates that at least 8.6 million people would lose coverage by 2034 under the changes proposed by Republicans. The new cap on the state and local tax deduction would start in tax year 2025, providing an immediate boost to residents of high-tax states on the tax returns they will file in early 2026. The $40,000 cap would start phasing down to $10,000 once income reaches $500,000, and both numbers would increase by 1% each year through 2033. Tariffs get focus in U.S.-Canada meeting. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Canadian Finance Minister François-Philippe Champagne were set to hold a bilateral meeting late Wednesday on the sidelines of the Group of Seven Finance and Central Bank meeting. The counterparts were likely to broach the issue of tariffs, according to a Canadian official, a topic that has roiled the relationship between the neighboring countries for months. Talks among the G7 finance and central bank officials got underway, with Champagne vowing to get the senior policymakers to work in concert on an agreed-upon plan to bring stability to the global economy. President Trump's trade policies, including hefty levies on imports from Western allies, have unnerved financial markets and prompted business executives to scale back investment and hiring plans. The U.S. and Canada have been in a back-and-forth trade war for months. Trump and his administration have maintained 25% tariffs on goods that aren't under the original U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement Trade Pact. Canada imposed retaliatory tariffs on about $43 billion of U.S. imports, but has since provided exemptions to the automotive and manufacturing sectors to give them time to find new non-U.S. suppliers. The U.S. delegation had no immediate plans to announce new trade deals with any of the other G7 countries at the conclusion of the finance summit, according to people familiar with the matter. A spokeswoman for Bessent didn't return a request for comment. The Bessent-Champagne bilateral meeting comes as the two North American countries discuss a new economic and security partnership, with Canada, under Prime Minister Mark Carney, looking to have the bulk of the tariffs eliminated. Carney, however, has warned that the decades-long friendly relationship between the U.S. and Canada, highlighted by integrated supply chains, is history. In introductory remarks on the first day of the G7 meeting, Champagne said free and fair trade is a fundamental ingredient to stabilize the global economy, while acknowledging there will likely be tension among senior officials about the Trump administration's tariffs. Pro-Palestinian protesters attempt to disrupt Columbia graduation. Pro-Palestinian protesters attempting to disrupt Columbia University's commencement tussled with police Wednesday as they tried to march towards the school's main gates. "Let them go," about 100 demonstrators screamed as a line of police officers pushed people back, stopping them from crossing the street and getting towards the school entrance. "Get back," police yelled. Columbia has emerged as perhaps the most prominent target of the Trump administration's onslaught of financial threats and pressure on elite universities. Last year's main graduation ceremony was canceled because of safety concerns following weeks of pro-Palestinian protests that disrupted campus life. Columbia University Apartheid Divest, a pro-Palestinian group at the school, had called for the protest on social media. In a post Tuesday on X, the group urged demonstrators to get loud and wear a mask. "No commencement as usual under genocide," the post said. The Trump administration has canceled $400 million in federal contracts and grants, saying the school failed to protect Jewish students on campus. The Ivy League university agreed to an initial list of demands by the Trump administration, sparking outcry from faculty and students. The university's interim president stepped down in March as Columbia continues negotiations over the future of its federal funding. Free speech proponents have criticized a crackdown on pro-Palestinian protests as interfering with students' First Amendment rights. Some foreign students who participated in the protests, such as Mahmoud Khalil, have been held in detention facilities while the government seeks to deport them. Protesters say they want the school to stop investing in companies that do business with the Israeli government. On Wednesday, security was tight, with metal barricades surrounding the school. New York City police officers blocked people from walking towards the school. Flags, signs, and noisemakers were banned. Police kept protesters holding Palestinian flags contained to a corner across from the school. Claire Shipman, the university's acting president, was greeted by roars and boos from the crowd as she spoke at the ceremony. She told the nearly 16,000 Columbia graduates that academic institutions are pillars of a healthy democracy and must be protected. She also acknowledged the absence of Khalil, who remains detained at an ICE facility in Jena, Louisiana. To Gen Z, everything is a recession indicator. Offbeat economic gauges aren't new, but Zoomers take them to the next level. At first, it was higher egg prices, declining demand for cardboard boxes, and empty dance floors. Now it's low-rise jeans, flash mobs, even Lady Gaga's return to pop music. The TikTok generation's search for signs of economic strain has expanded to include, well, just about everything. To the extremely online, the portents of doom also include serif fonts, press-on nails, knee-high Converse sneakers, Lena Dunham's latest public departure from New York, and Gwyneth Paltrow's decision to start eating cheese again. Responding to a seemingly innocuous social media post with the phrase "recession indicator" has become a meme all its own. Sometimes the posts actually point to potentially troubling signs, like a recent partnership between DoorDash and Klarna that allows users to pay for meal deliveries in installments. More often, they simply spotlight a trend from the pre-crisis late aughts that has worked its way back around. TikTokers aren't the only Americans searching for clues in unconventional data, noting that government reports on inflation and the labor market can offer an incomplete or lagging picture of the economy. Investors, big and small, have parsed everything from credit card delinquencies to shipping containers at the Port of Los Angeles. Former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan famously followed sales of men's underwear, which fall when times are tough, because, well, who's going to know? Pop culture isn't bothering with those or even more traditional measures. People are eschewing Wall Street's preferred examination of the Sham rule or Treasury yields to invent their own. People need a narrative. They need something they can understand, said Christopher Clark, an economist at Washington State University. And if you're an average person trying to understand the economy, he said, you're not going to use the yield curve. Even if pant styles or Paltrow's dietary tweaks didn't happen to precede the next downturn, correlation doesn't equal causation, as economic data wonks have often griped. One money manager once demonstrated that the production of butter in Bangladesh could technically explain much of the variation in the annual returns of the S&P 500. But MAME indicators are sometimes connected to potentially meaningful trends, like shifts in household spending. Some observers point to emptier bars and nightclubs as evidence that more consumers are cutting back. A skincare company selling eggs would be a sign that essential goods are becoming luxuries, while the popularity of press-on nails might stem from customers cutting back on manicures. Others have observed that declining tips at strip clubs, subject of a viral tweet in 2022, could signal a decline in discretionary income. But a nightlife slowdown isn't showing up in the data. Revenue at bars and nightclubs in the U.S. increased between 2023 and 2024, according to a February report from IBIS World, and is set to rise again this year. Some recession indicators might have a less direct relationship to economic behavior. For example, the renewed popularity of formal workwear. One theory is that people feel less secure in their jobs and therefore more pressure to present themselves professionally. It isn't the first time people have turned to fashion for financial clues. Armchair economists have long cited the Hemline Index, which dates back to the early 20th century and hypothesizes that women's skirts get longer when the economy is worse. Research has challenged the theory. That hasn't kept data analyst Made Laporta from tracking the trend. Fashion is closely linked with how people are feeling, said Laporta, who runs the Instagram account Data But Make It Fashion. Trends don't have to be the only indicator or the strongest one, but they tell us something. At the end of March, she warned followers that some recession-affiliated fashion trends, like business casual and, yes, longer skirts, were making a comeback. Maxi skirts had nearly quadrupled in popularity over the past week, while corporate fashion had shot up 39%. "This is my stock market," she wrote. A few weeks later, the actual stock market tanked. The S&P 500 fell 9% in 1 week following President Trump's early April tariff announcement, though the market eventually recovered. Some might call that a coincidence. Laporta sees it as evidence that economic insight might be hiding in unexpected places. "A correlation is still interesting to look at," she said. Can cultural shifts in fashion, film, or music actually predict where the economy is headed? Economists say it's unlikely, but talk of recession has a habit of turning into a self-fulfilling prophecy. Households or businesses can pull back spending because of economic concerns, eventually spurring the very recession they feared. It's one reason why Wall Street is so reticent about the R word. In that sense, it could be that all this talk about recession indicators is actually the biggest recession indicator of them all. At the minimum, people are anxious, said Sean Monahan, a trend forecaster. Most of the time, when people are talking about the economy, it's a bad sign. Trump eyes privatizing Fannie and Freddie. Mortgage giants are doing very well, throwing off a lot of cash, President says. President Trump said he is giving very serious consideration to taking the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac public after years under government control. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are doing very well, throwing off a lot of cash, and the time would seem to be right, Trump wrote in a social media post Wednesday. The Wall Street Journal previously reported that the Trump administration has been discussing efforts to privatize Fannie and Freddie, with talks underway since at least last year. Bankers have estimated that the government stakes in Fannie and Freddie could be valued at hundreds of billions of dollars. Trump allies and other Republicans see privatization of the mortgage giants as a way to reduce the country's deficit and return money to taxpayers. The two firms have been under government control since the 2008 financial crisis, and attempts to release them since then, including during Trump's first term, have been unsuccessful. Fannie and Freddie bundle and sell mortgages with government-backed guarantee to protect investors from losses when homeowners default. That allows banks and others to originate more 30-year fixed-rate mortgages. Skeptics caution that privatizing Fannie and Freddie could, if not done carefully, drive away buyers of mortgage-backed securities and lead to higher mortgage rates. In his post Wednesday, Trump said he would be making a decision in the near future after discussing with Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, Federal Housing Finance Agency Director William Pulte, and others. A proposal circulated among members of Trump's team in recent months estimated that the privatized entities would be valued above $330 billion, with the government's stake at more than $250 billion. Fannie and Freddie would raise an additional $20 billion to $30 billion from new investors, akin to an initial public offering. A raising of that size would put it on par with the largest IPOs of all times. The administration has considered an executive order that could include directing departments to study privatization. DOJ opens probe of Cuomo's testimony. The Justice Department has opened a criminal investigation into Andrew Cuomo, a top Democratic contender in the New York City mayoral race, in response to a referral from House Republicans who accused the former governor of lying to Congress about his actions during the COVID outbreak, according to people familiar with the inquiry. The inquiry follows the Justice Department's dismissal of corruption charges against the city's current mayor, Eric Adams, a move that drew objections from career federal prosecutors who were either fired or quit in protest. Adams is running for re-election as an independent, while Cuomo is leading polls in the Democratic primary. A Justice Department spokeswoman declined to comment. The investigation was earlier reported by the New York Times. The investigation is being handled by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington. It stems from a referral accusing Cuomo of lying in closed-door testimony about his role as New York governor in a state report on nursing home deaths that resulted from the COVID pandemic. The report was later found to have significantly undercounted the people who died in the state's nursing homes early in the pandemic. Cuomo spokesman Rich Azzapardi said the former governor testified truthfully to the best of his recollection about events from 4 years earlier, and he offered to address any follow-up questions from the subcommittee, but from the beginning, this was all transparently political. Azzapardi questioned the timing of the investigation. "This is lawfare and election interference, plain and simple," he said. Two Israeli embassy staffers killed. Shootings occurred near a Jewish museum in Washington, D.C. Two Israeli embassy staff members were shot and killed near a Jewish museum in downtown Washington, D.C. on Wednesday evening, according to Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. We are actively investigating and working to get more information to share. Please pray for the families of the victims, Noem wrote on social media. We will bring this depraved perpetrator to justice. Tal Naim Cohen, a spokeswoman for the Israeli embassy, said in a statement that two embassy staff members were shot this evening at close range. On Wednesday evening, local police said they were investigating a shooting in the area of 3rd Street and F Street Northwest in Washington near the Lillian and Albert Small Capital Jewish Museum. The museum focuses on Jewish life in the Washington, D.C. region, according to its website. And that's it for today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Ken, your volunteer reader here at the Talking Information Center, and I thank you for listening.